It's episode 31 of Piled High and Deep, the podcast, and today we're drilling down into the depths of quantum physics. Coming your way will be terms like superconductivity, Josephson junctions, superconducting networks, single flux quantum pulses, and get ready for this one, cryogenic memory. It's really cool stuff. No, seriously, this is some cool stuff, like nearing absolute zero kind of cool. Today our journey is with Dr. Sam Benz. He's a physicist that's on the cutting edge of hardcore get in and get greasy technology. It's really cool. Kind of reminds me of the stuff we may have read about in science fiction books 20 years ago. Now, this journey for Dr. Benz begins with a love of math and an appreciation of physics, despite a less than great high school physics teacher. And it's after his junior year that Sam heads off to Chicago, and he is working in the Argonne National Lab. And by working, I mean, he's really building stuff and getting some great hands-on experience. And it's as a result of this great introduction to a specific portion of quantum physics, he finds his path. It's just that he has a little bit of a challenge.
I got interested in superconductivity and went back to Luther for my senior year. I had to write a senior paper. I researched superconductivity, right? And because I got excited about that and was interested in it. Didn't know anything about it. There was no class on it in my small school.
So that's one of the takeaways here in our conversation with Dr. Benz. It doesn't matter what college or university you go to. If you find something of interest, then there are resources that are out there for you to jam that information into your brain, even if no one on campus knows anything about it. And especially today with the internet, you certainly have unlimited sources to get that information from. Now, here's the fun, timely part of my conversation with Dr. Benz. Did you happen to catch the news this week about how there's been a fundamental change in the basis for measuring things? Dr. Benz is part of a group of scientists working to remove what can be really viewed as the uncertainty of established tools for how we measure things like time, distance, and mass. We're moving away from what's called the artifact standard.
Such a standard depends on environmental conditions. It gets hot, it changes its length, you move it to somewhere else. You have if you clean it, you can remove some of the material, and then it's not a standard anymore.
Believe me, it's really kind of cool stuff, and you know, not just because it's near absolute zero, but we're changing how humanity needs to be thinking about these things, especially as we want to start thinking about moving off of Earth and the impacts that one measurement of gravity has that we may see here on Earth and how that's different from other places. And, you know, you can't really weigh a kilogram in zero G. Well, anyways, I'm not going to spoil the story. Sam's got a great story, and we talk about some really nifty stuff. And if you do want some more information on some of the things that we'll be talking about, I'll have links in the description that you'll be able to get additional information to. All right, so before we get started here, I got to say thanks again to Andy Schneidkraut over at Albums on the Hill. It was funny, I first met Sam back in December. I happened to stop into the store to purchase some Christmas gifts. Dr. Benz was there, as is typical. Andy and I, not just talking between the two of us, but engaging with anybody else in the store. And lo and behold, I find out Dr. Benz has his PhD, and we got together a couple of months later. It was a fun conversation. I was about to take off for a college trip with my son down to Arizona. So might have had a little bit else on my mind as I was driving this conversation, but I think you'll enjoy it. So let's start shoveling with Dr. Samuel Benz. I guess the moral of the story is getting old as hell. But it still is.
And it happens to everybody.
Yeah. which I guess is a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, part of that getting old as hell and learning how to understand how to deal with that in life. And
yeah.
I guess it's, you know, like I said, it's better than the alternative. As a physicist, do you tend to have a different perspective about what growing old is?
I do, in fact. Well, my kids are always telling me, you always look at the world from, you know, from a physics and science and engineering point of view and understanding how the world works. And so when I have those injuries and things, you know, I want to deal with them just and solve the problems just like I do in my work and my science. So
was that kind of the way you were built?
I think so. Actually, I thought about it a lot in the last week and thinking about, you know, talking with you. I was always trying to understand things and solve problems. And I was always liking to build things. Like I built plastic models and model rockets, and I didn't necessarily take too many things apart. We have a plywood full boat in the garage that I built with my dad. My dad was a Old Testament Hebrew and Greek professor at a Lutheran seminary in Iowa. He did nothing with his hands, but the next door neighbor built one, and so he wanted to build one too. It's the only time I'd ever heard him swear was when we were building that together. You know, fiberglass. He didn't, you know, he had a lot of guidance from the neighbor, but I think he wanted to do that with, you know, with me as, you know, as a kid.
Being raised, I guess to put it simply, a biblical scholar.
Yeah.
Was religion in your house?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We had lots of activities at our Wartburg Seminary in Dubuque, Iowa, where he worked, at our church. Our Boy Scout troop was in the church. Yeah. Yeah. I remember, you know, we went to lots and lots. Whenever we went on vacation, we would stop and meet people that he had trained, and sometimes, you know, they would find a place for us to stay, or so all constantly people all over the country knew my dad, and whenever we were traveling we would meet with people.
And this is the only time I'll ask it, unless, yeah, you know, we talk, sure, about, has religion stayed with you?
Not as much
as a, yeah, science, because I find that fascinating.
Yeah. We did through the, you know, with the kids, bounced around between a number of Lutheran churches in Boulder County, but had some pastoral changes that made us less satisfied.
So okay, and this will be the only time that I maybe ask it. I reserve the right as the conversation continues. How do you balance religion and science?
Well, I believe there's no contradiction for me. Faith and science and how the world works is no conflict for me.
Growing up, mm-hmm, where did science grab you? At what age?
You know, I was always good at math, and I was always very curious, good at art things, building things with my hands. And I think it was in high school, I had a really bad physics teacher. I was like, it's got to be better than this. This can't be that bad. And I thought I would major in math and physics in college, and I did at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. I don't know, I just was good at it and liked it. And that, you know, just continued.
Was college easy for you?
My wife and I met in college in math class, and actually in a the first year, freshman year English required class. And she and a lot of my friends were kind of mad. I'd kind of sleep through math classes. Teacher would call on me and I'd answer because I'd read it in the first 5 minutes and then kind of doze off.
Right.
So the math was pretty easy. The physics was difficult. You know, everyone hates introductory physics. Blocks and planes and forces and things like that. What really got me interested in physics research was a summer job I had in Chicago at Argonne National Lab on a linear accelerator.
In college?
In college, before my senior year. And they had a lot of national labs have summer programs for students, college students, and I got one, and I was good at drafting, And so they had me design. I'd never designed an electrical circuit layout or anything. I'd never worked in a lab like that before. They had me learn about a microwave amplifier chip, which was, you know, bigger than my thumb
right.
back then, and lay out a circuit board for it that had the right input and output connections that they could put in the circuit that drove these superconducting resonators. These big it was a giant cavity with niobium metal, superconducting metal, coated inside it. Two big niobium arms with holes in them that these ions would accelerate through. It was a microwave cavity that resonated. And they wanted me to build some electrical part that would run the microwave circuit. And that's why I'm completely scared, right? And
but you're a physics kid.
Yeah.
You're not an electrical engineer.
No. They.
So as you're designing this,
yeah.
I looked at the dissertation.
Well, I had a lot of help, a lot of mentoring.
Right, yeah. You're not doing it by yourself.
Yeah.
But you're given enough rope not to hang yourself.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now,
learned how to go to the go to the parts store, work with the electrical designer engineers. The funniest thing was I blew one up the first time I put it on the board. And it was like a $100 chip, which was a lot back in the early 80s. And I was terrified they were going to be mad at me. They didn't care. Here's another one. That was a huge deal.
Yeah, you know, you didn't have any sense of what budgeting is, and they knew that you were going to blow stuff
exactly.
up, so they had it in the budget. It wasn't that big of a deal.
Yeah, it was very different.
Right.
They had it was a government lab, so I had like steel-toed boots. I had a pair of prescription glasses that they provided for me, and a uniform I could get dirty like the engineers.
Right.
I was always good at getting along with not just the scientists, but the engineers and the guys running the thing. And what started me in the direction of my thesis was this place, was those superconducting parts. They made the superconducting shell of this cylinder by shipping sheet of niobium and copper somewhere in northern Maine and piled dynamite on it and blew it up. It's called explosive bonding.
There's a company down the road in Louisville that does that. Yeah, it's called all I remember is, this is weird, and if you've listened to the podcast, you know that my brain just kind of flirts off on other stuff. But in a previous life, I did a lot of sales and business development, so I was always looking for companies.
Okay.
And
there's one in Louisville.
There's one in Louisville.
Really?
At least it used to be.
Okay.
But they had the best. It was a public company. They had the best ticker symbol. Boom.
That tells it all.
That tells it all. Right. Absolutely.
Kind of like Goop.
and that's fascinating technology because if you think about it, you use explosives to blow stuff up.
Yeah.
My godfather up over on the Mesa, up over here off of 93, ran the water department. Up on the Mesa, where 93 and 72 are.
Sure.
My summers, because I went to Boulder.
Yeah.
I'm really getting off it, but
that's
is cool. My summers, I would spend with him. He ran the water department. He built this water department for this small. And I remember going up there, and to do the water lines into some of those houses, we needed to dynamite the trench.
Really?
Yeah. So you've seen the videos of, you know, at mines where they're, hold on, that's my timer. Don't need that.
Okay. So you got to blow stuff up?
Well, I drilled the holes. My godbrother and I would delicately put the explosives in the holes.
How old were you?
19, 20 years old.
Wow.
You know, and then you turn the crank and it goes, and you know, and then you're with a shovel, you're digging that stuff up out of the hole. Yeah, it's not a tremendous amount of explosive power because all they're trying to do is just make this trench and you don't want stuff flying around because there's still
and it gets rid of rocks and debris and stuff too. Because I ditched which my backyard for my sprinkler system.
Yeah.
I hated that.
Well, the funny
dynamite sounds way better.
Yeah, dynamite is way better. I was talking to my mom this morning. She's complaining, you know, the snow, it's so thick down in Pagosa Springs. I said, Mom, you're going to be in New Mexico. Why don't you just grab, you know, stop by a fireworks stand and get some M80s, and then we'll toss them up on the roof. And, you know, that was after, that was 2 minutes after we were talking about the avalanche video from Highway 550 up on Red Mountain Pass. But, you know, we're diverging here.
You got the dynamite from this boom company?
No, we didn't get the dynamite from the boom company, but that's just the way my brain works, just remembering some of that stuff. My godfather actually worked for a company in downtown Denver. I don't know if they're around anymore, but he worked in the mining industry.
Okay.
So, I mean, he knew what he was doing. We weren't just, I mean, he was an explosives expert. You know, it's always kind of fun to say, yeah, my godfather, he knows about explosives, you know, and for a kid with the last name of Conti, it works great as a story.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's amazing what they can do with explosives. Not only can they destroy stuff, but they can make stuff with it as well.
So the first I had heard of anything like that, I just thought that was really cool. The whole experience was a good experience for me.
Physics, you said that even though you had the bad physics introduction,
right,
you knew that there was something there, that there was something palatable.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up with a father who, you know, an academic, mm-hmm. did you get a sense that you wanted to generally follow that academic path?
No, not really. So he was kind of really serious and did some really hard things. He got his PhD at Johns Hopkins, and he did his thesis on ancient Phoenician language, and it's still a go-to book for anyone wanting to look at that. I don't think that's the right title, but I never read it.
Okay. We won't tell them.
But it's out there, and people still, they're still stocking the libraries, you know, in language and literature, language sections, and it's, you know, it's pretty amazing. Surrounded by other professors from divinity schools from being around the seminary, but I don't think I was headed in that direction from the start at all. I didn't know what I was going to do. You know, my parents then, you know, weren't pushing me in any directions.
They just wanted you to go to college.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't even know if they were expected that either. I don't know. It just sort of worked out that way.
Brothers and sisters?
My brother, I have one brother. He was 2.5 years older than me. He went to the Air Force Academy here. So that was actually my first experience
in Colorado,
other than coming through on vacations. And he had more of that those interests, so I kind of watched what he was doing. He wanted to get into the Foreign Service. And he was doing great at the academy, but he realized that if he stayed one more year, so he'd done the boot camp, he'd done the second year, you know, out in the woods, and then got thrown in the in the prison, you know.
Where they really test your mental.
Where they really do the mental anguish stuff. He did fine with all of those things and had good grades and was running cross country there. But he was like, my career is this other thing. He really liked that Lawrence of Arabia movie. He wanted to be that. I want to be Lawrence, I think. Anyway, I shouldn't say that. He never said that. But, you know, he left, and they asked him, you know, come back if you want. But he went to Johns Hopkins, and he had so many credits from the academy. He only needed one more year, but Hopkins made him go two. He started doing all the Foreign Service tests and couldn't get it. Did the written test and aced them and set up this interview, and he goes down to Washington, D.C. from Baltimore to do this this interview. And they looked at him like, you're not even graduated from college. You're way too young to be in the Foreign Service. You can't do that yet. And he just frustrated him. So that was really odd that they sort of put this roadblock in front of him that, you know, he couldn't do that. So he ended up getting a degree at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, and then became a lawyer, went to Stanford Law School. And I sort of saw that path as it was evolving. But, you know, my dad came from a my dad's dad, my grandfather, homestead in North Dakota, sod hut and house and everything. And 10 brothers, three sisters, and only my dad and one other brother, I think, went to college. Certainly beyond college. He was an engineer and my dad went into ministry. So.
Right.
It wasn't a big family thing.
Was there a point in undergrad that you decided then to, that the PhD was the path, or were you still just looking at, well, what was your attitude at, when you were finished, when you get that Bachelor of Science in Physics?
A Bachelor of Science in Physics and Math, and I wasn't sure which one I was going to do. But I thought, my dad did set the example. It wasn't a strong, there was no pushing or anything. And I was like, well, I'm still interested in this. I'm still good at it. My math teachers at college had me teach a couple of classes when they were gone, even in the class I was in. So...
Did you make the kids call you Mr. Benz?
No, I didn't. I didn't. It was embarrassing, right?
Right, yeah.
To be asked to even do that. I guess it just seemed natural thing to do, to go on to graduate school.
What is it for you? And some of this questioning may be a little bit self-serving because my son, who is a junior in high school, is considering a physics astrophysics path for college. Mm-hmm. We're going to the University of Arizona next week for spring break. We're going to tour there. We're going to be at Arizona State as well.
Okay. Sure.
Some really interesting programs and stuff going on at Arizona State. But what is it for you about math that grabbed you?
I just like the logic of it and. It just seemed very straightforward to me. I didn't really like writing, doing proofs and that kind of stuff. But when I connected it with physics in the sense that, they usually have two different beginning courses of physics, one with the math and one without, right? And so when you understand the calculus and know that math, a lot of the physics makes more sense, makes a lot more sense. And so they were kind of combined for me and together, but
you just knew that you knew early on that you had the amplitude for it. The amplitude that,
We do a lot of amplitude. In
yes,
my job.
You do. Yeah. Well, we're going to talk about that as well. As a former ham radio guy, I kind of got a little bit
good.
Of what.
Oh, I'm excited what you to were talk to you about.
Well,
it.
You
nice.
Know, it was a long time ago and my code skills are junk these days. So, it was Luther College.
Mm-hmm.
Where was that path next, and how did you decide to?
I ended up at Luther because they were actually recruited me with some money.
Okay,
as a student, and they actually looked for kids who were getting good grades in high school. University of Iowa, I had applied to, and they didn't really show any interest in me. It's a big place, right? I'm really glad I went to a small school. I've tried to encourage my kids to go to smaller liberal arts schools. My oldest son has, because they're very different experiences. Because you really get close to the professors, and the classes are small, and they write good recommendations.
Well,
letters.
They do, and one of the things that I've found in these conversations that I've had is that the path to the PhD is. Yes, it's important about what you've been able to fill your brain with.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also the building of the relationships.
Exactly. The mentoring was phenomenal that I had, both in physics and math, and the support that I got.
Again, that self-serving question, what's more important for that kid looking to go the distance? You say the smaller college experience perhaps is better. Is that because you have a better opportunity?
Have advantages and disadvantages.
Right.
And kids should always pick what's their best fit. My kids all chose their thing.
But it is about the relationship you build in your undergrad that propels you forward.
I think so. I don't know. I think I'm kind of jaded in the education systems these days at how they're become businesses and so forth.
Yeah, we don't have. Yeah,
we don't want to go into that.
Especially with the news, today,
giant growing administrations and so forth. It's a whole topic we can avoid.
Yes, absolutely. So, how do you make your decision on graduate school?
Graduate school was very straightforward for me. You apply. You take the GRE tests, you apply to a bunch of places, you write some letters to people.
But this is the mid-80s.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't have the internet.
So here's the path from Argonne National Lab. I got interested in superconductivity and went back to Luther for my senior year. I had to write a senior paper. I researched superconductivity, right? And because I got excited about that and was interested in it. Didn't know anything about it. There was no class on it. My small school, and I got a lot of background on it. Looked at what I thought. Well, maybe that's something I could do. You know, maybe I can blow something up. maybe that's something I could do. You know, for my PhD because it seemed interesting and exciting. I also looked at high energy physics because I was at this accelerator, and I looked at all those research papers with 100 co-authors on it, and I didn't want to be involved in that. So, you know, really superconductivity got me excited, and I looked at where were there good programs and research in graduate school for that, and I applied to those places and wrote a couple introductory letters to the professors there. I don't know if that had any impact on my, you know, success at applications at any places. My GRE score in physics wasn't great. I didn't have any graduate level courses already, which a lot of undergrads do going to universities. So I wasn't as prepared, I think. So my scores weren't that great. I didn't practice any tests; just went in cold.
Oh, you're one of those guys.
Well,
you test well.
I didn't. No, I don't. I actually don't.
Oh, good. Okay.
Bad scores. I didn't have great scores. So I don't know how it happened, but I got into Iowa State, University of Iowa, and Harvard University, and didn't get in to places like Cornell because, you know, they were score focused. So it was, you know, you go to the school.
So you end up in Boston.
Yeah, I end up in Boston.
Now, first question, how does a small town Iowa kid, what's your initial impression of Boston? Big city, great history.
Well, so my dad had done sabbaticals every 7 years. So we lived in Israel twice. He did archaeology there. I used to walk around digs and pick out glass perfume bottle shards and pottery shards. And I found an entire pot one time that no one had found one like that before. They said it was because I was short and closer to the ground I could find those. But we had toured all over the place, took a ship back with with the car we had stayed on. We toured my mom. I don't know how my mom did it with my dad's salary, but we went to all these places. We toured Europe. We lived in England for a year when I was 14. That was a phenomenal experience. I was the Yank in the class.
Was your mom a stay-at-home mom?
So before she met my dad, she was actually an executive, a secretary for Kimberly-Clark in Baltimore. And she was from, you know, Oshkosh, Wisconsin, a single daughter.
She go to college?
Stepfather. She had scholarships, too, and never did. So she went to college after I graduated from Luther and finished her degree at University of Dubuque, and then went and got a master's degree after that.
Wow.
After
you had
done.
Right.
Yeah. So she was pretty amazing, really good with, you know, financials and managing money. You know, we would go to a bed and breakfast in England somewhere in Wales, and she would negotiate a lower price because she didn't want the breakfast. I mean, she was phenomenal. The whole Europe on $5 a day thing for the whole family.
Right.
Right. So I got to experience lots of things throughout my life. I learned Hebrew for 6 months when I was 5 in Jerusalem. So just, I had all sorts of interesting experiences just because my dad traveled.
What did, was there ever a part of you that wanted to maybe not necessarily follow in your dad's footsteps, but did you have any interest in that ancient history kind of thing? Or
I went to a lot of museums growing up because my mom liked that. And I saw a lot of it. I was much more interested in, I hated it when I was younger, more interested as I got older.
And now you really appreciate it.
I wasn't into history.
Wasn't too malleable, didn't make a lot of sense.
It wasn't my thing. But I did like to travel, I learned. Traveling was very exciting to me. I do a lot of it now, all over the world. So I think I do more than my brother.
What was your Harvard experience in the 80s?
Well, it started in an interesting way. Again, there was another stepping stone. I arranged a summer job after my graduation from Luther at IBM Yorktown Heights in New York, again, in superconductivity. And this was the first time it was in superconducting electronics.
Okay, so let's hold there. Let's define superconductivity.
Okay. Superconductivity is a quantum phenomena where a metal... when it's cooled below a certain temperature, the electrons behave in a coherent state that allows a current to flow with zero resistance.
Okay.
So it's a quantum phenomenon like atomic phenomena.
Okay.
For example.
And we're talking about...
That's why they use it in those resonators. They have very low resistance. They can make very high... They can get a lot of power... coupled into the right places in those resonators to move.
So when my wife complains about the house being too cold,
yeah,
I'm just going to tell her, no, we need the temperature lower because it's more efficient for the electrons powering the television.
Well, it does happen that, you know, as you cool copper, the resistance does go down. So there is that effect. But it's not superconductive.
What are the metals that make that you use in superconductivity?
Almost exclusively, the superconductor we use at NIST is niobium. It used to be called columbium. It was found in Colombia.
Okay.
And it becomes superconducting around 9.2 degrees above absolute zero, 9.2 Kelvin. So we usually operated it at temperatures of helium that is liquefied, which is at 4 Kelvin. Now we're getting back right into the weeds quickly, which is about half its transition temperature, and that's where we can exploit those properties.
So you start having fun with this type of science.
Yeah. Back in college. Yep.
Is it... What can you explain what it is about that specific issue or topic that really got you going?
Well, doing that research paper. I mean, it started with explosive bonding and seeing this big, very large instrument being built, exploiting superconductivity. I want to learn more about it. I did that in my senior research paper. I don't remember exactly what I wrote in that at this point, but it got me interested in quantum phenomena. I think my senior year at college, we did a modern physics course that did all of the relativity stuff, all of those things. So it kind of seemed like, oh, it's this neat, cool, newer physics, like relativity, but it's something I can get my hands in, right? Because I worked with engineers who had their hands in it, you know, back at that summer job.
So... Is it fair to say that you like the idea of having your hands dirty and being able to have a physical attachment
yes.
to that rather than maybe that
Absolutely.
Theoretical part of it that still is pretty cool, but it's...
Excellent point, yes.
It doesn't seem real.
That's exactly what happened. Superconductivity is well in the domain of physics called solid-state physics and not theoretical. So when I got to Harvard, I could have... taken the path to go to math. I went to one party with math majors, and that was enough for me. Talking about theorems and stuff, and I don't think I lasted very long maybe an hour at that party. So I was done. It's going to be physics.
So honestly, when you went to Harvard, you were a little open-ended between math and physics.
So I still don't know how I got into Harvard, but it had to have been my recommendation letters and my prior experience, because it wasn't my test scores. It must have been other things. And what's awesome is that the graduate physics department at Harvard actually takes that into account, because a lot of these other universities don't. And I see that a lot, not only in my career, when I was at school, but afterwards. A lot of people are really good with the testing and books. I wasn't. And that's detrimental to finding good experimental physicists, I think. So it's a concern I have. When I'm hiring and looking for staff or students, it's not the test scores. In fact, I've had professors tell me, well, he's not my best student, blah, 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 and we get these guys and they're just phenomenal because of their other skills.
Thinking is important.
Yeah, and being able to problem solving is what I think of as physics. I mean, engineers do too. I'm a trained physicist, but, you know, in my job we do material science, engineering, electronics design, all of the, we do software.
Yeah, that was definitely a question I was going to ask at your level. Mm-hmm. with your experience, you've been a PhD now coming up on almost 30 years. Mm-hmm. You're not very many steps away from what someone would consider a professional engineer.
Yeah, since I came to NIST, I've pretty much been doing engineering from the first day I got there. To be able to realize the ideas that I had to become one. I sort of, my advisor from Harvard, Mike Tinkham, has passed away. He wouldn't want him to hear it, but I kind of put his book away and got out the engineering book of Van Duzer from Berkeley.
Well, isn't...
Right the day I got there.
Right. And I think we'll get to this again, but that might be the difference between, have you stayed in an academic path, mm-hmm. and I'll get to asking that question now, but you are in a practical, everyday, working with physics, mm-hmm. solving problems, identifying questions, you know, mm-hmm. coming up with those questions to ask. So that changes maybe how you work within physics to meld that with engineering.
The graduate program that I had, and most are broad, although I think some of the electrical engineers that we've worked with mostly do a lot of modeling these days. But in physics, I mean, I changed pump oil, and I built sputtering systems with, of course, help with other people, designing machines. We basically built a clean room at Harvard that doesn't exist anymore. They built a really nice one now. But, you know, we did everything from understanding the fundamental physics of what we're doing and trying to find new interesting phenomena based upon it. We used computer workstations to simulate and model the physical equations that we had and some of the physical effects that we do. So we did everything in graduate school, at least in Mike Tinkham's group, from simulation and modeling and designing circuits and building them in a clean room and then test and measuring and building the instruments, electronics you needed to measure it. When I came from graduate school, I strongly believed that a lot of technical advances relied on who had the best instruments and who could build the best instruments. And I still see that even in the what's going on now with the acceleration in quantum computing circuits and development. So that diversity of skills I saw immediately from back at Argonne National Lab to IBM, working with my mentors there, to my graduate work with the grad students and people at Harvard.
So on your dissertation, it's 1990. Tell me about the years that are leading up to that. When did you find yourself at Harvard? What about 84, 85?
85.
Okay.
It was five years I got out of there, and I was in a hurry. there were a couple guys that were there when I got there and still there. They weren't in a hurry. And that everyone has their own pace.
What was the plan going in for you? What did you see yourself
doing?
Well,
here's all of these tools. So we had, there was a far infrared laser. There was a guy on that. There was another guy working on a really low temperature refrigerator and looking at devices at millikelvin temperatures, fractions of a degree above absolute zero. He was working on that. And I started working with Martin Forrester, a senior mentor of mine, student, who was working with one of Mike Tinkham's assistant professors, who was actually running the lab, Christopher Law. And he had a lot of ideas for students to try. Try this. Go think about this. And what Martin was working on was to realize something called the Kosolitz-Dallas transition, using arrays of these circuits and making them shifted in a position by a certain predetermined amount that you could model in a computer called positional disorder. You take the centers of them and move them a small amount. And by seeing how that effect would change this phase transition called Kosolitz-Dallas transition. And Kosolitz, who's a professor at Brown, came and visited us. He got a Nobel Prize in the last couple of years. And I remember meeting him. And now he has a Nobel Prize for discovering this effect with this other theorist, Thales. So, of course, nobody knew he was going to get that Nobel then. But so I worked with him and supported that measurement. We built some other instruments for making those devices. And that was one of my first graduate research papers, which was co-authoring something with Martin.
What are the practical applications of that work that you were doing in graduate school leading up to your PhD?
I don't know if there were any practical applications. Was it just understanding those physics effects and to learn more about them and learn about this phase transition? And by supporting this older student who was going to graduate before me, I was learning the skills that were in the lab and absorbing them. How to make, here's how we make these chips, and then we advance those technologies. Also, here's how we cool them down. These temperatures, we mount them in this probe and put them in this glass doer with liquid helium in it.
So by making, you guys are you're making your own
chips. Learning skills,
right?
Basically, unusual skills for that field.
But you're making chips. You're taking the
superconducting integrated circuits made in a clean room we did there, and we didn't always have photoresist that we do now. They used ruby lith, which was a piece of plastic you would cut out with an X-Acto knife, which I was good at because of all the models I built.
Right.
And then we ended up being able to afford a contact aligner that allowed you to get a mask that had the metal already patterned, and then you could transfer that to these silicon chips.
Right.
So all of those things we were bringing to that group and developing for that group that were being used elsewhere and
etching your own boards.
Yeah. One of my other mentors who is now working with me here at NIST that I met there was Professor Horst Regala. He was there on I don't know if it was a sabbatical or a way that he was getting his second PhD, his professor doctorate. Working on some modeling of some supernatural phenomena in this group. And he was an inspiration because he had he came from this lab in Germany that they had built their own machines that evaporate niobium onto these circuits called sputtering guns. And they have magnets in them to focus the plasmas to bombard argon ions to knock that niobium off. And he basically had one sent from Germany from his lab, and I built a machine to put that in to make the circuits that I built. So there were all sorts of places I was getting good mentoring and I saw people like him and Chris Lobb and Martin being able to do all of these diverse things. Horst Regala is this professor who could do this mechanical stuff and design, machines and tools. He also wrote the software for controlling the scanning electron microscope to make it an e-beam lithography tool, electron beam lithography tool, and coded that, right? And we were doing everything. And being able to see people who could do everything was something I wanted to be too.
How quick were you able to identify what that dissertation path was going to be?
Oh, it was sketchy. I kept looking for something new to explore, and Chris Lobb actually threw me a lot of ideas and things to try related to this. So the other quantum device that we should bring up is something called a Josephson junction.
Okay.
And Brian Josephson, people should look up the history of this guy, especially an article from a retired NIST gentleman, Don McDonald, wrote the history of Brian Josephson's PhD, and his advisor, Nobel laureate, didn't believe his work and didn't want to publish it, thought it was wrong. He basically predicted these quantum effects of tunneling and coupling between superconductors, and it was completely, you know, different from anything that else had been done before. Well, Josephson eventually gets the Nobel Prize, and McDonald's magazine article explains it all. It's really interesting.
I'll put a link. I'll make sure that there's a link to it on
I don't know. I'll get it to you.
Okay. No, I'll put the link on the description.
But a Josephson junction is basically a weak link between these two superconductors. It's a two terminal device. So you take two superconductors, you bring them close together, and it can be any weak link. It can be a thinner superconductor, a different superconductor, but lower TC. It could be a normal metal, an insulator, whatever you want. And what happens is all of those electrons that are acting coherently in each superconductor, they're paired into what's called Cooper pairs, and they act coherently. I don't know if you've the Bose-Einstein condensates that got Nobel Prizes here at Gila and CU at NIST. Superconductors have been Bose-Einstein condensing since they were discovered, you know, over 120 years ago. So they can be, all those electrons coupled together can be described as a single state, or they call it a wave function.
Okay.
And those functions can overlap and cross through that barrier and couple to each other. And so you can get supercurrents flowing through that broken device called a Josephson junction. And it has special properties. So you can run a current through it up to something called a critical current, and then it starts to generate a voltage. So there's no resistance, just like a superconductor, until you exceed that. And in that voltage state, it does really interesting things. It acts like an oscillator. And the voltage that it gets biased at with whatever current you send through it, the frequency of those electrons and the supercurrents oscillating through that junction is exactly proportional to the voltage perfectly.
Which is something you don't
see. It's one of the Josephson effects.
Okay.
It's not possible in any other technology. And so we exploit that quantum effect by using microwaves, and we apply microwaves or periodic sequences of pulses to those junctions of the right amplitude, and train that supercurrent to an external microwave signal and get it to do special quantum behavior, like it wants to lock to that external frequency over some range of current. So it creates these things called quantum voltage steps or Shapiro steps, and that's a really interesting phenomena, because you can generate those at specific voltages exactly proportional to that frequency, and the proportionality constant is fundamental constants, Planck's constant over twice the electron charge. And we can talk about the redefinition of the International System of Units later.
Yeah, we're going to get to that here.
But it's exactly related to that. So it's a perfect proportionality constant, voltage to frequency conversion through fundamental constants, exact. And people have done experiments at Stony Brook University, shown them to be parts in 10 to the 17 and 10 to the 19. With no deviation.
Okay.
So it's a fundamental physical phenomenon.
So the work that you're doing to get to that PhD,
mm-hmm.
to get that point, how long does that take you to finish up?
Well, that's what happened. Martin's positional disorder, two-dimensional circuits with magnetic fields applied, look for these Casas-Thales transitions, and, well, let's see what happens when we put microwaves on them.
Okay.
Because, you know, we might see some interesting two-dimensional effects. Chris Lobb was very interested in percolation and effects, where he did one experiment where he would take sheets of different metals and then place them in between two wooden boards and drill holes in them to make them into weak links, and then measure the tensile...
The strength of the metal.
Strengths of what was left with the holes, and study the phase transition of how long it would take for this, how many holes and so forth.
Okay.
Looking for phase transitions in these metal sheets. Really interesting stuff that, you know, undergraduates, I think he had an undergraduate working on that. So it's just sort of progressing. Why don't you try this?
Right.
And let's look for some interesting physics. And I succeeded in that by applying both magnetic fields and microwaves to these circuits that I built with different types of electrical characteristics, and found some two-dimensional effects where vortices creating circulating currents from the applied magnetic field. So superconductors also have a Meissner effect that causes them to generate currents to shield magnetic fields. And then you take some network that already has holes in it, you put magnetic fields in. Well, if you get the field just right, you can get patterns of circulating currents in that network, and they'll order, like alternating flux quanta. They like to repel each other, just like other things, because they're circulating in the same way. They're opposing each other, and they'll order themselves. And so we're going to look for some ordered effects of vortices or circulating currents in these 2D networks and see what happens. And I found some interesting coherent phenomena that at certain fields that were at fractional ratios of fields, so you could count integer numbers of flux quanta, and they ordered themselves, one in every three, one in every two, three out of five, we could see that there was some coherent behavior going on that in the voltage state that you could get different critical currents for the different fields. And then I applied microwaves and saw more interesting things from that. So it was from my assistant professor's idea to look at two-dimensional phenomena.
So your path to the dissertation, you discovered...
Classes, lots of work in the lab.
Right.
And then trying different things from the skills I had already done.
Right. So it seems like it really is that traditional PhD in which you're not making a grand discovery, but what you're doing is you're building upon, you're providing a little bit more information to what's already been built behind you.
Right. Well, these were undiscovered effects that I had found.
Okay.
Based on intuition from, you know, one of the advisors I had, you know, to try this and see if there's anything interesting that comes out of it. And it did.
What was the practical application for what you did, or was it just providing additional information for people to take the next step on?
I don't think it wasn't looked at like that.
Okay.
It was the goal was to find or understand new and interesting, you know, physical phenomena, applying quantum effects and exploring what they might be doing in two-dimensional networks.
Okay,
and what could we learn from that, and what would be new and interesting? We were hoping maybe for some new phase transition phenomena. I found interesting behavior, and then I had to explain it. Why is it doing this?
Did you enjoy the explanation process?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you enjoy writing?
No, I hate writing.
Hate it. But you do an awful lot of it.
Yes. I far prefer editing. I'm better at suggestion than I am writing.
Okay. What did you do after... Do you remember the title of your dissertation?
Let's see.
It's always
dynamical properties of two-dimensional rays, something like that.
Okay.
The term we coined, the effect I discovered, was fractional giant Shapiro steps.
Fractional giant Shapiro,
steps. And it was quoted and referenced a lot, made some Science News article. There was the two-dimensional behavior that was going on seemed to be very much related to some of the other quantum phenomena being discovered in two-dimensional electron gases, the fractional quantum Hall effect, some of these patterns that we saw in terms of ordering with magnetic fields had the same exact pattern that was going on in this other effect. So a lot of theorists were trying to draw parallels, and it was just interesting.
So you're done with the PhD. What do you do next?
I had some ideas that developed out of the PhD that I wanted to explore further and turn them into something practical, oscillators, for example, which is what I was interested in. And I interviewed at a number of places that had in industry that had research programs of superconductivity, and I applied for the NIST NRC postdoc fellowship, writing a proposal for these ideas, and fortunately got that award and was able to continue my ideas, you know, here at NIST, and I stayed on there and still work there. So the oscillators didn't amount to anything, to make a long story short.
As you're finishing your PhD, were you convinced early on that you did not want to go down the academic path? Did you ever have that intention?
So as an undergrad, I did teach, you know, some of the courses. I was a teaching assistant there. I was a teaching assistant also at Harvard to help pay for my way. Because I was good in the lab, I finagled a way to get into Tinkham's group my very first semester. And because I had a lot of lab experience already, and I also TA'd to help pay for it. An interesting story is one of the reasons I convinced him to let me join his group at that young age. Usually you don't start working
in the lab until you
finish the coursework 2 years later or so, right? I was very fortunate to have a small scholarship, not a huge amount. I think it was like $5,000 or $10,000 from I guess a trust in Iowa. A radio personality from Cedar Rapids set up a foundation to support Iowa kids who were going to to graduate school. His name was R.J. McElroy. And I drove from Luther College down to Cedar Rapids to interview for this after having written a proposal, been selected from my college to represent the school. And I almost didn't get this thing. But because I had that, it allowed Tinkham to not have to pay me as much for the first couple of years. I had that for 4 years. And that actually opened a door for me. And I wish there were a lot more people creating foundations with their, you know, excess retirement money to support students to, you know, to
for their graduate education.
And that really, really benefited me from Iowa. And I almost didn't get it. One of the undergrad research projects I was doing with one of my physics colleagues from Luther, we had set up a solar... Luther had out in the middle of a farm field a little observatory building with a telescope, and we set up a solar detector out there, and we just took solar measurements daily, and ended up with an undergraduate research paper. My first research paper was that. Well, we were out goofing around out there and, messing around with it. I think maybe had a beer out there. I don't remember. But we were driving back, and I realized, oh, my gosh, I'm supposed to have my interview with the Luther teachers about this fellowship, and it was scheduled, and we're late. And we're like, oh, crap, I have no excuse. We're already late. But we were driving so fast, we slid the physics truck off the road into a ditch. And that was my alibi. They said, nope, you missed it. It's too late. I said, but the truck went in the ditch. So they let me interview it, and I ended up being the Luther representative. And they told me it really doesn't matter because a student from Luther got that award last year and they always rotate it. You'll never get it. I got it. It was awesome. And that enabled...
That's a key development.
That enabled... That made a stepping stone that made my path easier in graduate school.
You said you've never... You came to Boulder. You've never left NIST. What is it about that organization, that group of people that drives you?
NIST is a great place to work. Really smart people. I get mixed up on how many Nobel laureates there now are, but there were three or four more since I joined NIST.
Right.
Quite a few here in Boulder and a couple in Gaithersburg. NIST, only 10% of NIST or less is here in Boulder. Most of it's in Gaithersburg, Maryland.
For people that don't know.
Yeah, National Institute of Standards and Technology. It's on Broadway in Boulder. It's part of the other federal labs there. It's not the NOAA building, which is the nicer, newer one that everyone sees on Broadway. And it's not NCAR, which is up on the Mesa. It's NIST. It's the old 1950s concrete building that Eisenhower dedicated. And that's where the atomic clocks were developed. And you can see the NIST, the atomic time on the sign out front. Just a lot of really interesting... There's the radio station. Actually, I think they're decommissioning that.
Are they really?
But your computers have a piece of software in them that goes and checks NIST time at one or two other places on... So you can have a really crappy quartz oscillator clock in your computer that drifts every day by more something you could notice, and it resets regularly off of through the internet.
Right, and, you know... This nifty little cell phone's not working without NIST either.
So when I got to Boulder, just really, really good people and really down to earth people, that people interested in the outdoors, a lot of rock climbers. I'm not a rock climber, but there were a lot of them. I was into hiking and fishing. We played volleyball every lunch, with a bunch of guys that I wasn't working with, but I got to know. One of them discovered a dinosaur out in Wyoming. They named it Drinker Nisti. Drinker wasn't because that's what they were doing.
Right.
It was named after a famous archaeologist. So just really interesting, smart people, creative and supportive. And there were a lot of interesting things going on there. And again, I had good management support and smart
you continue,
people to work with.
And you continued the work on the superconductivity.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Never have left superconducting devices, but many different applications associated with them. So I came to work on oscillators and explored that and did what I could with that. It never led to anything productive because I had to coherently lock many of those Josephson junction oscillators together to get enough power to make something useful. It turned out that there's lots of good microwave sources. You don't really need those. There was research going on in superconducting digital computing at that point, and I got interested in that, and there was work to be done, so I kind of did both for a while. Moved a lot of things along in a lot of directions. My mentors there, Richard Kautz and Clark Hamilton and Dick Harris, were very supportive. Clark Hamilton had some interesting ideas. And this led to the use of my understanding of the use of Josephson junctions and these quantum effects for electrical measurements we call metrology, using those quantum effects to make standards. And I've been doing a lot of that standards work for, you know, three decades now.
So that kind of comes to how you and I met at Albums on the Hill.
Right, right.
You know, Andy, who's great and responsible for a whole bunch of these interviews that I have here, you know, we're chatting it up and you tell me your PhD in physics and I just mouth off some inane knowledge that I keep in the back of my head about, you know, what about, you know, them changing the whole kilogram the way that,
That's right. That is what happened.
So it's, you know, you're going to correct me cause I'm wrong.
Yep.
So the kilogram has changed. The way we measure a kilogram, it's no longer measured by just mass. It's now measured by volume. Well, okay, it's more based on the total number of atoms of a certain element, right?
Well, there's a couple different ways to do it. There's two experiments that were done over the past few years. One was to use Avogadro's constant, which is counting the number of atoms.
Right.
And the Germans made these beautiful, perfectly spherical silicon spheres that people can Google it and get an image of it, and you can see people looking at it like with their reflections like a mirror.
Okay.
The other one was something called a Watt balance. It compared mechanical and electrical power. They're now calling it a Kibble balance, named after the guy who realized that electrical, mechanical, it's basically a weight, you know, like a regular balance like you would think of. It's got a pulley and counterbalancing arms, one for electrical and one for mass.
Okay.
Okay. And what he realized was that he was just originally using it to measure current. When you're moving this mass and you have this coil and magnetic field, you can generate a voltage or a current through this coil. And what he realized that the quantum electrical effects that I have already mentioned, the quantum Hall effect and the Josephson effect, both of those essentially have redefined electrical measurements based on those quantum effects. Quantum Hall for resistance and the Josephson effect for voltage, because you can realize quantized values of voltage and resistance by designing circuits appropriately in quantum Hall with two-dimensional electron gases and superconductors with the Josephson effect to make these just like atoms and lasers create light using these coherent effects. You have these other quantum phenomena with electrons and superconductors to make a perfect resistance and perfect voltages that are only dependent on fundamental constants, and in the Josephson case, converting frequency to voltage perfectly. And the reason we can make that a quantum behavior is that the frequencies are locked to atomic clock frequencies.
Okay.
So most people think of atomic clocks for time, but they're also using microwaves, and those microwave frequencies are used to make that atomic time standards, and so they have very good frequency is inverse seconds, so it's related that way. So those two quantum electrical effects allowed that balance to not just be a current measurement device, but to be because you have those quantum effects, you could now make electrical power perfectly and compare that with the mechanical power of moving this mass at a certain velocity in the gravitational acceleration. So if you go through the equations, you get mass times gravity times
right.
velocity of this moving thing equal to current times voltage.
So is the
and resistance.
So the intent of making this change,
yes,
is to provide a more constant
the whole
measurement.
Yes. So
is it a constant measurement that is applicable not only on Earth or in gravity one, which is Earth, and then that translates then to that same measurement outside of gravity?
So we want to have our understanding of the laws of physics be equivalent everywhere.
Right.
Okay.
And it's hard enough because we don't have the metric right. system around everywhere.
Right.
but that's a whole other issue.
But you want to have a system of units that is unchangeable and can be realized anywhere. And so what the quantum Hall and Josephson effects allowed people to do, and the atomic clocks, was to realize time and frequency and voltage and resistance equivalently anywhere. So people were building these instruments to realize those things. And all of a sudden, you've got many decades, many orders of magnitude improvement in national labs around the world being able to measure things the same by exploiting the quantum effects. So people realized this, I think, in the with the atomic clocks in the 60s, where they redefined time based on the atomic clock, not by the rotation of the Earth.
Right.
And I think it was 83, they redefined length as a result of lasers being good and counting the number of wavelengths of a certain frequency, again, based on the atomic clock. So we got rid of the... we got rid of the meter bar,
right?
That was a physical thing, and we call that an artifact standard. Such a standard would, you know,
depends on
environmental conditions. It gets hot, it changes its length. You move it to somewhere else. You have if you clean it, you can remove some of the material, and then it's not a standard anymore. And that's exactly what was holding back. The International System of Units was this kilogram. They lock it away in a safe in a vault in Paris at the BIPM, which is the French acronym for the International Standards Lab. And every time they brought it out, they would, which was very rarely, maybe three or four times, and the cleaning process they thought was very good, but it seemed to then be different from the other standards they had made that were supposed to be identical. But it was the definition of mass, and if and when they change it, they don't know. It wasn't the same thing. An artifact standard can't ever be the same. So you want to base your system of units on unchanging fundamental constants. And on May 20th of this year, 144 years after the meter convention in Paris that defined the metric system, that's when it will happen. And back in November, I got to attend the Paris vote where the administrators and committee people and representatives from all the governments around the world voted to make the change on Metrology Day in May of this year. So for the first time, the world will have a system of units that's not based on artifacts. It'll be based on fundamental constants of nature, which is awesome. And the electrical quantum effects enabled this change, as did the atomic clocks and lasers and these other quantum behavior. And what's interesting is the kilogram was this real massive thing. It's like the first thing you would think of for a standard, right? You go in markets for centuries, you know, they had balances. And, you know, you got to make sure no one's cheating on that mass you're comparing it with.
Right, keep your thumb off the state.
Yeah, and the silver coins that you're using, and how do you keep those standards? Well, if you have the right measurement tools now, you can realize that anywhere. And so the fundamental constants, so the International System of Units was previously defined as a set of base units, and now it's being defined by fundamental constants whose values are fixed. So over the last decade, people were doing measurements to measure those fundamental constants, and I personally was involved in helping to measure Planck's constant and Boltzmann's constant, and providing the best measurements we could with the lowest uncertainties for all of these different experiments. And you want to, whenever you try to, when you're, if you're going to read a fundamental constant, you want to have many different measurements of both the same type and some that are different, so that they're using different physical behavior, and you want to make sure they get the same answer. Otherwise, if you have some systematic error in some measurement and everyone's doing the same systematic error, it's going to be wrong.
Right.
So you really have to compare them with different things. So these fundamental constants now have defined values to some specific number of significant digits that the experts called co-data came up with based on how good the measurements all were. And they're defined values, and those all go into effect in May. And I think I'm excited about that, because since I've been working at NIST, our quantum voltage systems were not part of the International System of Units. They were separate, but they were better. Do you know the definition? So current was a base unit. No one could measure it in a fundamental way. The definition for the ampere was, I'm going to get this not perfectly correct, but based on the force that you would measure between two parallel wires with an amp flowing, and the wires had to be infinite.
Right.
No one knew how to measure this, regardless if they were infinite or not. Right. It's too hard an experiment. How do you measure the force between parallel wires separate, you know, of any length?
Right.
Right? It's just impossible. But it made sense from a mathematical point of view. And some of the early electrical measurement instruments were ammeters. There were a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
So they defined them on that and not on electrical potential. So it's just a lot of weird stuff.
And if I remember right, it's not the voltage that kills you, it's the amps.
That's right. That's exactly right. So the standards for voltage were mercury cadmium batteries,
right,
basically. And they would make them very accurately and identical in certain ways. And nobody wants a standard based on mercury anymore anyway. We have had to get rid of them all. And they would disagree with each other at parts in 10,000. And as soon as the Josephson effect was discovered in 62 and then started to be applied in later in the 60s and early 70s, the microwave behaviors were determined, they immediately realized they could make voltage much more accurately than these batteries, and it immediately improved the measurement uncertainty that people could get agreement across the oceans by three orders of magnitude. It just changed everything. So I'm happy May 20th. We used to have buttons that said no legal volt, because the legal volt was a specific instrument in Maryland and at every national lab that they all had their own batteries or they had their own other standards. And all of these quantum instruments are supposed to be identical, right? They are identical. So you shouldn't need... There shouldn't be any difference between them. And of course, you need to compare them to make sure they're being operated right. Just like an atomic clock, right? They're flying around on satellites helping your GPS work.
Right.
It's the same thing with quantum voltage standards that we build at NIST. They're all identical. We can actually self-calibrate them internally by putting half of the circuit at plus 5 volts and the other half at minus and compare them. We inter-compare them and make sure the systems agree with each other around the world. My group sells them as a standard reference instrument, so we have a clean room at NIST. We've had many clean rooms for over the last 30 years where we build these chips, we build these instruments, and sell them to other national laboratories around the world, which are identical to our systems. And we've also applied them not just to DC voltages like for your batteries, but to AC power at 60 hertz in your wall outlets, and to audio frequencies, you know, ham radio and music.
Yep.
One of the first demos I did for a NIST visitor day was to generate one of the things that I have a patent on with some other colleagues is to make perfect tones from an AC synthesized signal using these Josephson junctions, where we use pulses instead of microwave frequencies. It's essentially a superconducting digital to analog converter for people who know RF or audio stuff. And because we can convert frequencies and digital signals perfectly with these Josephson junctions, we can basically synthesize any audio frequency perfectly with perfectly constant amplitude, perfect harmonic quality. And so I bought a microphone and had some kids, you know, make a tone and look at it on the spectrum analyzer. You could see this tone and how wide it was and all the harmonics from it. And then I turned on my Josephson waveform synthesizer, which generated this perfect tone with no harmonics. It sounded horrible because there's no distortion.
Right.
Right. But it was perfect. It was going to be the same every time, and it was a good example to people that this is something very unusual, but this is what's different between a standard and somebody's voice or artifact standard.
You had mentioned quantum computers when we first kind of got started.
Right. That's a whole other aspect of one of the programs I run.
Right. So the stuff that you're working on, I mean, really does build on the future, on what's next when we get out of when we leave ones and zeros move to.
Well, we're mostly also working on superconducting digital computing. There's a program for the intelligence community, IARPA, that we're just winding up actually with companies IBM and BBN and Northrop Grumman to realize energy-efficient computing. One of the big problems with computing, the data centers that Facebook uses,
massive amounts of petaflop energy.
Computers. You the biggest computers that people are running now to do modeling for the weather, or for new materials, or atoms, or earthquakes, they require big computers, and they can power them basically with a small nuclear power plant.
Yes,
you know, 50 megawatts, such things, and they're also limited by the fact that memory is slow, and they're always memory starved. They don't have enough memory to do the processing that they need. And you might, many people might know that they've got quad-core PCs, right?
Right.
Silicon logic chips. Doesn't really like going faster than a couple of gigahertz.
Right.
Because it gets too hot, and it's dissipating a lot of heat, and nowadays, if you look at the processor, it's got a big heat sink on it,
yep.
Okay? And so most of the energy being dissipated in computing is in heat, and or in the supercomputers moving the data that's insufficient that they need to the processor. And so moving the data around is actually what's expending most of the energy in these big complex computing systems. So people have been trying to build a superconducting version of that, just that conventional digital computer, about three or four times since the 50s. And the first one, I sent you this article. It's a really interesting article. MIT, I don't even know if he was a professor. I think he was just an MIT student called Dudley Buck,
right,
who invented this element called the cryotron. And he was messing around with superconducting wires and magnets and making magnetic cores that could be switches, and patented the cryotron, where he could eliminate the superconducting property by generating a magnetic field near it and driving it out of its superconducting state. Well, he was doing that at the same time as Fairchild and these other guys were doing the semiconductor switches and trying to do them. He was right in there doing the same thing, making thin film superconducting integrated circuits that were actually more advanced, I think, than what they were doing in the semiconductors yet. And unfortunately, he died because he was working with materials to optimize, you know, these devices that were poisonous, they think. And it killed him at 32 years old. And he was a hardworking guy and making big changes, and very few people remember him. And since that time, GE and other places made big progress towards realizing one of the first integrated computers was a cryotron computer on a superconducting integrated circuit.
Okay.
Before the semiconductor ones, for silicon. It's amazing. But it never went anywhere because they switched too slowly. And it was because he was removing the superconducting property, which was heating up that whole wire. And that's very slow. And if only it had Joseph's injunctions, he would have been better off. Okay, so then there was an IBM computing program in the mid to late 80s that actually a lot of the clean room technology at NIST was exploiting and copying and moving forward when I arrived in 1990. And then high-temperature superconductors were discovered in the 90s, in the early 90s. And people thought, okay, well, now we can go up to higher temperature and not use liquid helium. We can use liquid nitrogen. It's cheaper and easier and should be more energy efficient. Let's use those. And there was a big effort to do that. The problem was those high-temperature superconductors are ceramic, and they make horrible Joseph junctions. You can't make them very similarly. So that kind of died. And then some other smart people. So quantum computing started moving along also here in the last decade or so. Similarly, cryptography and other applications that people were concerned about, and the power-hungry conventional computers that were basically stalling out. They couldn't. 50 megawatts was going to limit everything that was going to be built, right? They wanted a 10 or 1,000 times fast. They wanted teraflop computing, okay? And how do you get there? Well, one of the paths was superconducting digital electronics. So there's been a program to try to develop that using Josephson circuits. We have NIST is doing a lot of the test and measurement for that program.
So the Josephson circuit replaces the circuit that's built in the
Yeah, it's a completely different logic family. It's
But that's the way to think about it is,
yes.
Is the Josephson replaces the transistor.
Well, it's actually more fun than that. you can think about perfectly quantized voltage pulses generated by these junctions propagating around in these superconducting networks being gated by Josephson junctions. So it's basically a superconducting wire network with Josephson junctions to ground, and where these pulses we call single flux quantum pulses, they pulse around, and what's really happening is you can imagine a ring of magnetic field wrapping around a superconducting wire, and every time it passes through a junction, it generates that junction generates that pulse. And how you move those magnetic fields around through this network, you can do logic with that, and you can time it correctly. The problem again is we don't have a good cryogenic memory that's also fast. So these superconducting devices potentially can run 100 times faster than anything.
We just don't have the memory.
Don't have a cryogenic memory to go with it. Period. And we also don't have good interfaces from room temperature electronics optically down to it.
Reese,
so there's a whole.
My son Reese, if you're listening, I've figured out your PhD project. Go figure out cryogenic memory.
So we're thinking that these superconducting digital circuits will also be an enabling technology for superconducting quantum qubits and quantum computing. Because right now all of the superconducting qubits are driven from room temperature RF signal sources, and eventually you're going to need to control them down at qubits run at millikelvin temperatures again, just like that big fridge that I told you about back at Harvard.
Right.
Eventually you're going to want to have that control, the driving and measuring and controlling of those qubits as close to those things as possible. So superconducting digital circuits are a very obvious solution to do that, and we're about to a new national program has been authorized called Quantum Information Science Program. NIST is going to be involved in that. It hasn't been appropriated yet, but it's very exciting, and a whole aspect of my program run by Pete Hopkins has been working on superconducting digital stuff, and it's a lot of fun. In fact, while I was still a postdoc at NIST, that's what I had switched to because HITC had just come into play. And some of the first, I built some of the first, so this logic family was proposed by some Russians appropriating other single flux quantum, superconducting quantum interference device technologies that was invented here that I don't have time to go into. In the U.S., but I was able to build some of the first superconducting digital circuits as a postdoc at NIST based on a lot of the infrastructure that NIST already had for voltage standards and trying to continue the IBM digital program. I was able to design and measure some of those first circuits, and then now we're back to them again 25 years later working again on that. Thing. It took 25 years for people to recover from from the failure of high temperature superconducting digital to move on. But the whole cryogenic energy. So people have always worried, superconducting electronics. You've got to make it cold. There's no way that can buy you an advantage. Well, it does if you've got cold memory. And when you also factor in all of the power being spent in conventional computing on cooling all those hot
right.
processors and moving that data. If you do the full power energy analysis, you can replace an entire building of superconducting or semiconducting processors and petaflop computing with something the size of the kitchen table, like an MRI system that you got your back scanned probably.
Oh, that was a nightmare.
Right. That's run with superinducting magnets,
mm-hmm.
for example. So that's the size that you would replace this with if you had the memory.
If you had the memory. It's all there's always something. Two other quick things, and then we'll wrap this up. Were you a fan of science fiction as a kid?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've read... Still a long time since I've read it, but...
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, I was.
Was that a driver for you, maybe, in your life?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it always gave me the idea that there was more out there, more to be learned. Curiosity. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I was born in 62, the year the Joseph Effect was discovered. I didn't know anything about it till in college, but, you know, that the whole change in our country after Sputnik and the Apollo missions, you know, growing up with that was just huge.
And has science rubbed off on your kids?
My oldest is a chemistry major. My other two younger ones have other aspirations. But I think I've instilled in them an appreciation for data and analysis and thinking for themselves.
Kind of goes back to that, to the test issues.
Exactly. I mean, there's so our whole society is being impacted now by information and bad information and people's selective information. And it's a real challenge, right? Where do you get your information from? Quantum computing and voltage standards aren't going to fix that. But, you know, I still have a lot of hope that if people learn all of the facts. So I've always believed... So there's a couple things I believe, that the best science is done with the best instruments, and that the scientific method always wins, right? It's got to be reproduced. There's over the last 30 years, I know of a couple of examples where people have faked data and they weren't able to be reproduced, and people figured it out that they had made up data, and these guys were getting patents. I was involved directly with a couple of these, even in my own field, and people that I met personally and knew they were found out to be doing this. And there's lots of others as well, including, I guess there was a guy in Korea that was...
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, the scientific method always wins, and I wish we could apply that to daily life, because if people know all the information that's actually out there and they can evaluate it in an objective way, not just from their own points of view, but they can see a whole story, then they will make the right decisions and come to better agreement. And that I'm hopeful for that somehow. I don't know how to do that, but...
What if the aliens come and they're in base 13? What happens with our standards then?
Oh, they'll probably have the same standards.
They'll have the same standards. Yeah, we just got to figure out the difference between base 10 and base 13.
It'll be fine.
It'll be fine.
All right. It'll just be a translation. Direct translations, no problem.
Dr. Benz, thank you very much. This was a lot of fun. Really appreciate
it. Thanks, Ted.
Hope you enjoyed it.
All right.
Thank you very much, Dr. Samuel Benz, for spending 90 minutes with me. It was actually a little bit more than that, but allowing me into your house and for sharing your story. I really enjoyed it, and I hope you did too. And thanks for listening and taking what has been now in excess of 90 minutes to listen to another episode of Piled High and Deep, the podcast. A couple of quick notes. I will have links in the description. So if you're interested in finding out more about the work that Dr. Benz has done in terms of redefining what the world's measurement system is, you'll see a link for that. And I'll also provide a link to an article that Dr. Benz made mention of regarding the Josephson junctions. It's a really fascinating article, and he was able to dig it out, so you'll be able to get a link to it
there as well. Thanks again for listening, Piled High and Deep, the podcast. However you listen to it, please leave a, do me a favor, leave a comment in the comment section and let me know how you like it. Send me an email, ted@themountaingeek.net. I'm going to go take the dog for a walk. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.